Welcome to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds, a weekly podcast for pharmacists, physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners who are interested in learning more about clinical pharmacology topics. I'm your host, Garrett Schramm, Director of Pharmacy Education and Academic Affairs at Mayo Clinic. To claim pharmacology CE credit or to get a copy of presentation slides, visit ce.mayo.edu/pharmacypodcast. The 2016 American Pain Society guidelines recommend gabapentinoids, including gabapentin and pregabalin, for perioperative pain management. Given the recent focus on the opioid epidemic, providers are looking for non-opioid treatment options, but current literature calls into question the appropriateness of gabapentinoids due to their lack of efficacy, incidence of adverse effects, potential for abuse, and toxicity risk. I'd like to welcome Dr. Joseph Osborne, a clinical pharmacist at Mayo Clinic, to provide insight into the use of gabapentinoids for perioperative pain management.
Thank you, Dr. Schramm, and good morning. The gabapentinoids, especially gabapentin, are unique among medications in that their use is seemingly tied by word-of-mouth efficacy. In light of this, today we're going to gab about the role of gabapentinoids, pregabalin, and gabapentin for acute pain management and the perioperative setting. I'd like to start by describing gabapentin prescription trends over the last decade. From 2012 to 2016, we've seen an increase in the number of gabapentin prescriptions by 25 million, or a 64% increase. Notably, during this time period, there have been no new FDA indications for gabapentin, which, as I performed my research and prepared for my presentation today, I thought was very interesting. Tying this into the perioperative space, I believe that there are several reasons that gabapentinoids are being viewed as in a positive light in the perioperative setting. First, the opioid epidemic, with two encompassing arms, is likely for its use. In one arm, we have presumed safety and perceived efficacy of gabapentinoids, as prescribers may feel uneasy sticking to natural opioids as an analgesic option. On the other arm, in 2016, the American Pain Society recommended the use of gabapentinoids as part of a multimodal pain management, along with such medications as NSAIDs, ketorolac, and lidocaine. Lastly, use of gabapentinoids may be beneficial for enhanced recovery protocols in the surgical environment, as patients are being encouraged to ambulate frequently and recover in a manner, so that they can leave the hospital in a faster route. I believe that all of these different items tied together have likely led to gabapentinoids being viewed as a promising choice for acute pain management in the perioperative setting. As we investigate this today, I have the following objectives. First, we will describe the pharmacology of the gabapentinoids. Secondly, we will review literature pertaining to their use for acute pain management in the perioperative space. And lastly, we will identify new literature pertaining to toxicity, misuse, and abuse considerations for these agents. With that, I'll start with gabapentinoid pharmacology. And to understand the pharmacology of the gabapentinoids, one must first have a high-level understanding of the process of nociception. Nociception, or pain perception, occurs as a noxious stimulus encounters nociceptors, or pain receptors, spread throughout the body. The first of four stages of nociception, transduction, occurs as this noxious stimulus creates action potential, which is then transmitted along the spinal cord. That second stage, transmission, will occur as action potential is propagated from primary to secondary neuron and then up the spinal column to tertiary neurons in the brain. The third step of nociception, perception, occurs as that action potential reaches various areas of the brain and is interpreted by the body as a sensation of pain. The last and arguably most complicated aspect of nociception includes modulation, in which endogenous neurotransmitters may dampen or lessen the perceiving of nociception by action potential inhibition. The gabapentinoids specifically focus on alpha-2-delta receptor binding at voltage-gated calcium channels, to decrease action potential generation, as I will cover in the following slide. So again, under normal physiology, we have a noxious stimulus that travels along a primary afferent neuron and reaches the terminus of that neuron. Potassium is effluxed out of the cell, calcium is influxed into the cell, and vesicles containing various neurotransmitters migrate towards the synaptic cleft. These vesicles then excrete their contents into the synaptic cleft, where neurotransmitter binds to respective receptors, thus propagating action potential down secondary afferent neuron and further on into the brain. With gabapentinoids, however, this same process occurs as noxious stimulants propagates downwards towards the terminus, and under normal physiologic circumstances, calcium is free to move through voltage-gated calcium channels. However, with gabapentinoids present, a conformational change occurs at the alpha-2-delta receptor, thus blocking the ability to pass through this channel and, as a result, inhibiting action potential generation and transmission of pain perception. While this is primarily recognized as the mechanism of action of the gabapentinoids for pain, I do want to acknowledge that there are other potential mechanisms of action, including increasing levels of the neurotransmitter GABA, which are outside the scope of my presentation today. While the gabapentinoids do share a similar mechanism of action, they have some differences in their pharmacokinetics. Dosing of each gabapentinoid, which I have listed from 100 to 1600 milligrams for gabapentin and 75 to 900 milligrams for pregabalin. Gabapentin, curiously, has inverted bioavailability, with lower doses of gabapentin being associated with higher bioavailability and higher doses of gabapentin being associated with lower bioavailability. Pregabalin, regardless of dose, has constant bioavailability of approximately greater than or equal to 90%. Time to maximum concentration, or Tmax for gabapentin, also has an inverse relationship to dose, with 100 milligram doses having a Tmax of approximately 1.7 hours, and higher doses of gabapentin having a slightly longer time to maximum concentration. Pregabalin, however, has a Tmax of less than or around 1 hour. Dosing frequency for both agents is twice to thrice daily, with renal dose adjustments of note for these agents as well. The gabapentinoids also share similar FDA-approved uses, with gabapentin, which was FDA-approved in 1993, having approval for postherpetic neuralgia and partial seizures. Off-label uses, and this is by no means an exhaustive list for gabapentin, include fibromyalgia, neuropathic pain, and postoperative pain. Pregabalin, which was FDA-approved in 2004, includes the following uses of postherpetic neuralgia, partial seizures, fibromyalgia, and neuropathic pain, with the focus again for my talk today being specifically postoperative pain for both of these agents. I'd like to start off with prevalence of gabapentin FDA versus off-label use. And from what we can see is that data from 2016 showed 3.56 million prescriptions of gabapentin that were written, with a large majority, 83% of those, being written for off-label use. Now, this isn't particularly surprising, as gabapentin has a large slew of off-label uses. However, when we dive into this data a little further, we see that by evidence label per Micromedex, only 20.5% of these gabapentin prescriptions are being used with strong evidence for use. The remaining 79.5% of these prescriptions have either weak indications for use or no clinical indication for their use that they're being prescribed for. Also important to recognize with gabapentins are adverse effects, with in December of 2019, the FDA releasing a warning of respiratory depression with concomitant opioid and central nervous system depressant use. Common side effects for our gabapentinoids, that common being occurring greater than 10% of the time, include ataxia, drowsiness, dizziness, fatigue, and visual field disturbances, notably with pregabalin. Armed with this information, I'd like to ask our first question. Which of the following describes the mechanism of action of the gabapentinoids? And I would invite you all to respond at poll.ev.com@mayorx if on a desktop, or you can use your phone or cell phone app and text MayoRx to 22333 and then answer with A, B, C, or D. Answer A, binds to mu opioid receptors modulating pain perception. Answer B, attenuates the release of excitatory neurotransmitters via voltage-gated calcium channels. Option C, increases presynaptic serotonin and norepinephrine concentration via reuptake inhibition. And answer D, attenuates presynaptic GABA neurotransmission. All right, and I see our virtual respondents, their answers trickling in here. All right, seeing this, I should have bumped up the difficulty of my question. I do agree with the majority of you where answer B is correct. Answer A is incorrect, as this is the mechanism of action of the mu opioid agonist. Answer C is incorrect, as this is the mechanism of action for the selective serotonin and norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, or SNRIs. And option D is incorrect, as if anything, the gabapentinoids would increase, not attenuate, presynaptic GABA concentration. With that, we'll now move into evidence-based practice. In 2016, the American Pain Society guidelines recommended that clinicians consider the use of gabapentin or pregabalin for three primary reasons. First, it was found to reduce opioid requirements after major or minor surgeries. Secondly, it appeared effective whether the doses were being given pre- or post-operatively. And third, it had not been linked to respiratory depression, and other side effects associated with these agents was found to be minimal. In 2017, our colleagues across the pond published an editorial stating that the American guidelines suggest considering almost every available analgesic, but there is no guidance with respect to appropriate combinations of analgesics for specific procedures. With this in mind, we can see even with 1 year of this guideline being published, there was expert disagreement on where gabapentinoids really fell into play for pain management in the perioperative space. I also would like to define the parameters in which I use to evaluate the coming meta-analyses that I have to present on. First, to provide a landscape of the evidence summary, there is a large lack of double-blind placebo-controlled randomized trials regarding gabapentinoids for pain management in the perioperative space. What we do have is a multitude of smaller studies and meta-analyses that look at these, which I'll cover in the following slides. Evaluation criteria that I applied to each of these studies, I tried to standardize based on reduction in analgesia consumption, reduction in acute pain, and adverse effect risk. I would also like to note that as I look at the perioperative setting, this encompasses gabapentinoid use pre, intra, and postoperatively. With that, we'll start with our literature. First up, we'll be looking at a 2005 meta-analysis by Dolman et al. That focuses specifically on gabapentin. Next, we'll be moving into a 2015 meta-analysis by Ipe et al. That looks specifically at pregabalin. And lastly, we'll be looking at a fresh out of the oven 2020 meta-analysis by Verrett et al. That looks at both combined gabapentin and pregabalin. So we'll start with Dolman et al. This was a 2015 meta-analysis that included 133 studies with a population ranging from the mid-30s to the low 300s. Of note, 64% of these studies did include a population of less than 100. Outcomes with clinical significance in parentheses include the following: 24-hour morphine equivalence consumption with a 10-point reduction being deemed clinically significant, post-operative pain score at rest with a 1.5-unit reduction being considered clinically significant, and adverse effects reported in odds ratios. Methodology included placebo compared to gabapentin, with any dose of gabapentin ranging from 300 to 1200 milligrams for any surgery type. Additionally, this could be with or without subsequent doses. The predominant control and anesthesia type used is placebo and general, and our subgroups included type of surgery, additional postoperative doses, and studies with a high risk of bias. I also have listed surgery types, but unfortunately the authors did not comment on the percentage of surgery types present in these studies. I do want to focus and highlight on these subgroups here that in post hoc analyses, as the authors looked at these different subgroups, there were no difference to the primary outcomes that I'm going to report based on removing studies with high risk of bias, type of surgery, or additional postoperative dosing. Our first outcome is reduction in morphine equivalents. On our y-axis, we have morphine milligram equivalents, and on our x-axis, we have a 24-hour period postoperatively. We can see that gabapentin reduced morphine milligram equivalent use by about 8.44 and a value that was found statistically significant. When applying the author's cutoff of minimal important difference, however, we do see that this does fall short of being deemed clinically significant. Comparing pain reduction outcomes with gabapentin, we see on our y-axis pain reduction on a 10-point scale, and on our x-axis time postoperatively at the 1, 2, 6, 12, and 24-hour marks. Notably, all of these points were found to be statistically significant, with our 1-hour mark passing a minimally important difference set by the authors again at 1.5-unit reduction in pain on a 10-point scale. All other time periods were not found to pass that minimally important difference. Regarding adverse effects, gabapentin was associated with a beneficial risk ratio when compared to placebo, with risk ratios of 0.78 and 0.67, respectively, for nausea and vomiting. Both of these were found to be statistically significant. Sedation, however, was found to be at a higher risk, comparing gabapentin to placebo with a risk ratio of 1.18, again, statistically significant. I have a number of trials listed here. As we remember, there was 144 studies included in Dolman et al., so a fair amount of trials did look into these adverse effects for meta-analyses. With that, let's kind of summarize what we've talked about so far with gabapentin. The authors concluded there was no minimal analgesia reduction, minimal pain reduction, and a higher risk of sedation with gabapentin use when compared to placebo. Moving into pregabalin literature, we'll now speak to Ipe et al., which was a 2015 meta-analysis including 43 studies ranging in population from the mid-20s to the mid-200s. An even higher percentage, 88 of these studies, were found to have a population of less than 100. Outcomes examined were reduction in postoperative analgesia consumption, pain relief at rest, and adverse events. Our predominant control for this study was placebo and comparator, with our surgery types and number of studies examining surgery type corresponding are as listed, with what I'd like to point out of the vast majority of our surgery types being abdominal for this study. Additionally, there are important subgroups to call out for Ipe et al. As well. 30 of these studies were identified to have moderate to large risk, including randomization, allocation concealment, and blinding risk. Additionally, they also broke apart pregabalin into groupings by surgery type ranked with pain, and I can certainly answer more questions in the discussion period about this, but to briefly summarize, pronociceptive pain are surgery types such as orthopedic and joint surgeries, and our non-pronociceptive pain types are surgeries such as cardiac surgeries, ocular surgeries. They also had a group three that kind of like was a catch-all for surgeries where they weren't 100% sure what the source of pain was. Pregabalin dosing groups and timing of outcome assessment I have as follows, with the majority of the primary outcomes being reported from the 150 to 300 milligram group. With this, let's look at our first primary outcome, postoperative analgesic consumption. On our y-axis, we have a reduction in analgesia consumption expressed as a percentage, and our x-axis, we have a 24 to 48 hour postoperative time frame with, again, that 150 to 300 milligram group. We see a 16% reduction in analgesia consumption with pregabalin use, and this was additionally found to be statistically significant. Regarding pain relief at rest following procedure, however, on our y-axis, we have pain reduction on a 10-point scale, and with our x-axis, 24-hour post-operative. We see that two groups here, group one are pronociceptive surgery types, and group two are non-pronociceptive surgery types. Group two, those cardiac surgeries were not found to be statistically significant per Ipe, yet group one was found to be statistically significant with a pain reduction of rest of approximately 1 on a scale of 10 or 10%. It should be noted that the authors found this to not meet clinical significance. Regarding adverse events and specifically sedation, when pregabalin was examined, doses of greater than or less than 150 milligrams were not found to be statistically significant for sedation. However, higher dosing groups and combined dosing groups were found to be statistically significant with risk ratios of 1.43 and 1.51, respectively. With this, summarizing our pregabalin literature, we see that minimal analgesia reduction was found for pregabalin. Additionally, minimal pain reduction, as the authors did not believe that a 10% reduction qualified as clinically significant. And doses greater than 150 milligrams were associated with sedation. Last, we'll take a look at our 2020 meta-analyses by Verrett et al. This study included 281 studies with the following outcomes in clinical significance. First, intensity of postoperative acute pain being measured by greater than or equal to 30 points, being a clinically significant reduction with a 10-point minimal significant reduction also being assigned by the authors, cumulative opioid use, length of stay, and adverse events. Gabapentinoid characteristics measured include medication use, with the vast majority of our patients being on either gabapentin or pregabalin, and a small percentage being on both, and dosing regimen, with, again, the vast majority of our patients being on either single or preoperative dosing. But I do want to point out that there was a large mixture of the differing types of dosing regimens for this agent. Predominant control used was placebo, with general as our anesthesia type. And our surgery types were as follows, with orthopedic and spinal surgeries encompassing about 27%, abdominal surgeries, both laparoscopic and non-laparoscopic, encompassing 38%, and then a smattering of different surgery types reported in this meta-analysis throughout. Subgroups of note for the gabapentinoids in a combined setting were breaking apart based on pregabalin or gabapentinoid use, and then daily dosage regimen between high and low dosing, which I have listed on the slide. Similar to Dolman et al., neither of these subgroups was found to have statistically significant difference when compared to combined results that I'll be reporting on in the following slides. First, we'll look at combined post-operative opioid administration again. On our y-axis, we have mean reduction in IV morphine milligram equivalents at the 24, 48, and 72-hour time periods. A reduction in 7.9, 9.8, and approximately 29 was seen at each of these time periods, and it was found to be statistically significant by the authors. Combined pain reduction outcomes, as listed with a pain reduction on a 100-point scale on our y-axis and our time postoperatively on our x-axis of 6, 12, 24, 48, and 72 hours respectively, with corresponding p-values showing statistical significance. Notably, as we apply the 10-point pain reduction minimally important difference, we see that none of these none of these time points except for the 6-hour time point were able to meet that marker. However, applying a more stringent, appreciably important difference, we see that at any of these time points, be it gabapentin or pregabalin, they were not able to meet appreciably important difference in pain reduction outcomes. Length of stay was also an interesting outcome that I wanted to include that Verrett et al. Looked at, with hospital unit ranging from the post-anesthesia care unit, or PACU, ICU or intensive care unit, and hospital length of stay in general. I listed number of trials as considering that this was a very large meta-analysis, not a lot of these trials were examined. And we see that with a p-value listed on the slide, that both PACU and ICU length of stay times were not found to be statistically significant. There was, however, a statistically longer hospital length of stay in which the authors, and I agree, found that the mean difference of hospital length of stay was only 3 hours longer with gabapentinoid use. So unfortunate for our patients, but not clinically significant in terms of length of stay. Adverse events related by Verrett et al. Are as follows, with ataxia and fall, delirium, and respiratory depression, all found not to be statistically significant with p-values I have listed. Visual field disturbance and dizziness, however, were found to be statistically significant with a higher risk ratio of 1.89 and 1.25, respectively. Lastly, mirroring evidence from earlier, nausea and vomiting was found to be beneficial with the gabapentinoid group with a risk ratio of 0.77. Again, that was found to be statistically significant. Considering all of this, with recent literature, we've seen minimal analgesia reduction, minimal pain reduction, and a higher risk of dizziness and visual change with no meaningful effect on length of stay. Armed with this knowledge, I'd like to pose the next of my questions. Which of the following best describes current literature pertaining to perioperative gabapentinoid use for acute pain management? A, reduction in morphine consumption and pain reduction met appreciable significance. B, length of stay was found to be clinically significantly longer. C, use was associated with an increased risk of nausea and vomiting, or D, reduction in morphine consumption and pain reduction did not meet appreciable significance. All right, I'm seeing our responses kind of dry up here, so I do agree again with the vast majority of respondents. Answer D, reduction in morphine consumption and pain reduction did not meet appreciable significance is also the answer that I have. Answer A is incorrect because, again, they were found not to have appreciable significance. B is incorrect as the length of stay was only found to be 3 hours longer and not deemed clinically significant by the authors. And option C, use is associated with an increased risk of nausea and vomiting, is incorrect, as it was actually found to decrease risk of nausea and vomiting for our patients in the perioperative space. Armed with this literature, I'd now like to move to my final section, toxicity, misuse, and abuse considerations. The gabapentinoids have been associated in the postoperative setting of having a higher risk of postoperative naloxone use. Previous studies conducted at Mayo Clinic found that single preoperative gabapentinoid doses, were found to have an increased risk of postoperative naloxone use. A 2018 study, which included 128 patients from 2011 to 2016, matching patients 2-to-1 on age, sex, and procedure, found interesting results. Inclusion criteria for this study was general anesthesia and extubation in the operating room or post-anesthesia care unit with naloxone administration within approximately 48 hours of dismissal. The outcomes of this study summarized are the following. A single dose, contrary to previous information, was not associated with naloxone use risk. However, home continuation of gabapentinoids was associated with greater naloxone use. And there are two subgroups that I'll be looking into on the following slide, continuous home gabapentinoids combined, and then low versus high home dose gabapentinoids. Looking at this more in depth, we see that the home continuation postoperative naloxone risk was an odds ratio of approximately 6.3 and found to be statistically significant, so quite higher. Again, looking at our home dosing regimen, we see that with low doses of gabapentinoid, we have an odds ratio of 5.1, increased risk of naloxone use with the p-value that I have listed, and high doses being associated with an odds risk ratio of 14.1, again, found to be statistically significant. I do have dosing regimens listed at the bottom of the slide as well for our gabapentinoids. It does happen that patients, after they're discharged from the perioperative setting, will be sent home with a short supply of gabapentinoid, and I'd like to address the growing problem of abuse and misuse of gabapentinoids in the community as well. Data collected from 2004 to 2015 identified approximately 12,000 international adverse events that were reported. Of these, 75% and greater than 75% have been reported of occurring since 2012, so currently on an upswing. Additionally, it's important to consider that there's an all-population prevalence as high as 1% with gabapentinoid abuse and misuse. The general population aside, gabapentinoid misuse is also found in higher rates with vulnerable patient populations, including patients with substance use disorder, psychotropic medication users, and opioid users. And I have found abuse and misuse rates in parentheses there as well. In addition to the misuse component, there's also been reports of increased odds ratios of opioid-related death with pregabalin use. High-dose pregabalin has been found with an odds ratio of 2 in terms of increased opioid-related death, with low-dose pregabalin having an odds ratio of approximately 1.52 with opioid-related death. Lastly, the gabapentinoids have been associated with increased recreational abuse, with crushed oral tablets being used intravenously, misuse with alcohol, which I can personally attest to on my previous psychiatric rotation, having several patients admit to this, and concomitant use with controlled substances. With this in mind, the regulatory landscape of the gabapentinoids is fairly interesting. Controlled substance status for pregabalin has remained stoic at a C5 scheduling or Control 5 substance scheduling since its inception by the federal government. Gabapentin, however, does vary by state with its scheduling. In 2017, Kentucky was one of the first states that enacted controlled substance status for gabapentin, with Tennessee closely following in 2018, and my home state, Michigan, right on their heels in 2019, establishing gabapentin as a controlled substance. Of note, even in states that do not have gabapentin classified as a controlled substance, we are still having to report gabapentin prescriptions to a prescription drug monitoring program. For the members of the audience that practice in Minnesota, they know that this is to be true, along with other states such as Nebraska, North Dakota, and West Virginia. So there is still this growing concern evidenced by controlled substance status of gabapentinoid and at least gabapentin misuse in the communities. I'd like to get a feel for what the audience experience is with gabapentinoid misuse and abuse in your field of practice. So if you could answer this poll with A, I have not experienced any misuse or abuse of gabapentin in your practice. I have experienced moderate misuse or abuse, severe misuse or abuse, or you don't use gabapentinoids in your field of practice. All right, I see the final results trickling in here, so I'll go ahead and remark on this. I was actually very excited to see what the results are from this slide, considering, and it looks like option B is the majority of the audience feelings, where they have experienced moderate amounts of misuse or abuse with gabapentinoids in their practice. Considering this, I want to compare that to pharmacists' perception of gabapentinoid abuse in their community. In 2019, Kentucky pharmacists were surveyed on their perspective of abuse and diversion of gabapentin being a problem in their community pharmacy. So this was only looking at pharmacists in the community setting. And we can see that 90% either agreed or strongly agreed that gabapentin misuse and abuse was an issue within their community. So I think it's quite telling that there's likely some form of misuse and abuse going on with this medication. With all of this together, I'd like to summarize my findings for you. The good things that we know about gabapentinoids: they're associated with a reduction in nausea and a reduction in vomiting, which would be beneficial for patients in the perioperative space. Additionally, all of the outcomes were found to be statistically significant in terms of pain reduction or reduction in analgesia consumption. Lastly, gabapentinoids are not opioids. Therefore, they may come with less or perhaps different baggage than an opioid analgesic would. There are, however, some bad things about gabapentinoids. As we've discussed, there's been minimal reduction in pain on visual analog pain score scales, minimal analgesia consumption reduction, adverse effects such as ataxia and sedation being quite common, an increased risk of naloxone with evidence stating to one-time preoperative dosing and continuation of home gabapentinoids, and abuse and misuse risk in general that we just discussed. Lastly, there are several unknown items regarding gabapentinoid use. There are no robust randomized controlled trials regarding their use. We're still unsure if the importance of surgery type is, if there is an importance associated by a surgery type, as the meta-analyses that I covered had conflicting evidence on this. And preoperative, postoperative, and single versus multiple dosing is still up in the air in terms of importance. With that crystal clear answer, I wanted to provide some clarity in terms of what I think an ideal candidate for gabapentinoid use would be. This patient would receive 150 milligrams of pregabalin respectively, as it showed better pain reduction than gabapentin, for a one-time preoperative dose. Their renal function would be at least above 60 milliliters per minute, and they would be ineligible for other analgesia types such as NSAIDs, lidocaine, ketamine, etc. I also believe that this patient would be best qualifying if they had no history of substance abuse, no concomitant respiratory risk, and no continuation of home gabapentinoid, considering the increased risk of naloxone use with that. I also believe it would be important to have this patient be inpatient. That way, if they did experience a respiratory event, we would have the ability to handle this, and adverse event profile in the outpatient setting could be dangerous as they're driving home and being discharged from their surgery. Naturally, patient-specific characteristics should be considered for these patients and taken on a case-by-case basis. With that said, I appreciate your time and your attention. I'd like to open up to questions and discussion.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more, subscribe using iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Thank you for listening to Mayo Clinic Pharmacy Grand Rounds. Join us weekly for more exciting clinical pharmacology topics.